Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. We've looked at modern folklore before on the podcast, in our episode with Dr. Lynn McNeil. And we've also explored urban legends, both in history and more recent times. But I'm not sure that we've ever had the chance to amalgamate all of these things at once. At least, not until now. Recently, we had the chance to interview someone who, as you will hear in the first few minutes, could legitimately be described as a modern urban legend, or as a product of digital folklore. That is, the author known as Chuck Tingle. Not much is really known for certain about Chuck, outside of the fact that his name is obviously a pseudonym. He presents as many things in interviews, some of which are obviously fictitious, but others of which may not be. In particular, Chuck's comments in this interview on neurodiversity seem very genuine. Whilst he's been known for many years for his somewhat off-the-wall self-published erotica, Chuck has recently become more mainstream, with his horror writing being traditionally published. His first horror novel, Camp Damascus, which we hear about in this interview, has achieved USA Today bestseller status and is well regarded. This is a fascinating interview, which I think will come as a surprise to many, whether they think they know Chuck and his work or not. Behind his privacy facade and slightly affected voice, Chuck talks eloquently on horror writing and tropes, genre deconstruction, and much more. I hope you enjoy this insight into Chuck and his work.
Hi, this is Hillary Wilson here for the Folklore Podcast, and today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Chuck Tingle. He is a mysterious force of nature, splitting his time between Billings, Montana and California. Nobody has seen his face, but plenty have seen his sunglasses and pink mask. He's the synonymous Hugo Award-nominated author behind such well-known titles as Pounded in the Butt by My Handsome Sentient Library Card, who seems otherworldly, but in reality is just a natural part of the priceless resources our library system provides. And my butt is comforted by the realization that I'm okay and everything will be all right. He's written fantasy novels such as Trans Wizard Harriet Porber and The Bad Boy Parasophilus, and the Select Your Own Timeline adventure Escape from Billings Mall. He has a board game to his name and two podcasts. And most recently, Chuck has published the horror novel Camp Damascus through Tor's Nightfire imprint. Not everything that people say about Chuck is true, but the important parts most certainly are. Welcome to the podcast, Chuck.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I am thrilled to be here. I think that folklore in particular kind of interesting to me. And as we very briefly chatted about before, I guess I myself, when I was listening to that intro, I thought, old Chuck, I am a piece of folklore. I don't know how many episodes of this when you actually have the mysterious cryptozoological entity itself on the show. I don't know if that's arrogant to say. I don't want to label myself as a big piece of folklore just yet, but I do think that there's some elements where it seems very appropriate.
You're definitely hard to catch on camera, just like a Bigfoot.
Yes,
people
that's
hear
true.
Of sightings of you like Mothman. I think that you are genuinely part of the urban legend.
Yes,
and we there's definitely more, have not had that on.
No, there's more. There's probably more photos of a Bigfoot without a mask on than there are of old Chuck. So that's true. Very, very mysterious.
Yeah, you're a very interesting part of the modern internet landscape. Because although you had been publishing since 2014, I believe, it wasn't until the Hugo Awards fiasco that a lot of people started knowing your name. And since then, I think the mystery has only heightened for the most part.
Yes. Well, you notice it, from my perspective, I'm there the whole time, so I'm keeping track of when these things happen. I would say, big bump after the Hugo Awards. I think what's interesting about that too is I was pretty dang popular before that as well, they're just, you know what it is? There's just this series of events, and I'm pretty bad at memory, so they all blend together. But, you know, I have over 300 tinglers, which, you know, I do a lot of writing. I define the tinglers as just kind of the erotic shorts that exist in sort of a complete world. And a lot of those are based on current events. So there's big spikes in awareness of me, Hugo Awards being one of them. But every single current event tingler is like this little... this little peak, and then I'll go down, and another little peak that's a little higher. And that's been going on for about 300 books. So, you know, now here I am permeating every corner of the dang internet.
It was fascinating to me when, ChatGPT started really taking off, that people were accusing you of using that to write your books. It was fascinating to me because I was wondering if they had actually been keeping up with you at all, you know, because you've always had, you know, a very steady output.
I've been doing this for 10 dang years.
Yeah, Morgan Daimler has a similar, you know, quick output with their writing. So it just was fascinating to me. It would be like saying Stephen King was using that to come out with his books. You know, some people just write much more quickly.
From what I know, I have never, I very much avoid all this AI stuff, but from what I understand about ChatGPT, I don't even know if I just said it right, but the way that it seems to basically only do summaries, you know, and then if someone's going to use it, they would have to rewrite that summary. And I guess I feel very not threatened by it, because if there's one thing that I think I'm pretty quick at, it is the story beats. I kind of think that's the hardest part. It's pretty easy for erotica shorts, to be honest. You think of a problem and then you solve it through sex. It's a pretty much a one plot beat when you're writing those shorts genre. But really, it's the ideas, and I can come up with the idea quick. So I don't know. I feel like a speed writer, even using an AI as it is right now, would probably not even be as fast as old Chuck, because that could maybe give them the idea and lay out the basic paragraphs for them to edit. But when I sit down to write, I already have the layout in my head. So I don't know. I think I could compete against this machine pretty well so far.
It reminds me a little bit during the Victorian time, there was the popularity of the chapbooks, where people would write like very short, spooky stories, and they would be putting out hundreds upon hundreds of those, you know, within a fairly short time period, because again, you're just creating the problem, and in this case, not solving it through sex, but maybe not even solving it, because these often had pretty bloody endings.
Yes, that's true.
You go on.
Just make the problem and talk about how terrible it is. That's actually a pretty good basis for a short horror story, is create a problem, show how bad it gets, and someone dies.
I think that was Edgar Allan Poe's general outline for most of this.
Yes, that's true. I think of tinglers too. I think what's fascinating is, I feel like most of the 10 years I've been doing this has been a struggle to be taken seriously as an artist, has basically been the whole journey. And thankfully, I think most buckaroos understand what I am doing now. Instead of thinking of it as a sort of artless scam, or I don't really know what they thought, understand that I care deeply about it, and that this is a sort of maybe a tingler specifically, a sort of a maybe a gonzo queer art form, maybe in the way of, you know, John Waters or something like that is maybe where it's more seen, which is nice to be taken, you know, have my art actually appreciated in that way. But I do think that that process Well, it has taken me all over the place. And the way that I have finally come to understand it, or I guess what I've always thought about it was, you know, we used to have print magazines, and those are still around, but that kind of way of getting news has kind of gone away. And then we have, you know, blog posts and stuff, and it really speeds up. We have social media posts. And so for someone to take the news and then to filter it and give their opinion on it, which is what I do. I see an idea and I think, well, what do I think of this? And then express that as a piece of erotic art. To me, isn't that unusual? I think it's unusual in that I don't think it's really been done before at the scale that I have. But it always kind of made sense to me. I think, well, if there's this news article, I'm gonna take it, internalize it, artistically synthesize it, and then release it. I remember I got an angry review once saying, it's so obvious that Chuck saw this on the news and then had big feelings about it and then put out a book. And I just thought, what does this person think art is? It's just the most bizarre way of trying to downplay what I do. So it's been an interesting journey, but I'm glad that kind of overall it's kind of understood in a different context now.
One of my favorite things that some authors have been doing lately is advertising their books by quotes taken from 1-star reviews online.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, oftentimes things that people hate about a book are something that someone else is 100% searching for.
Oh, yes. You know, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Oh, it's fun. I mean, in terms of, you know, you wanting to, you know, be taken more seriously for the content, you know, within what you're writing, I've run a book club for a couple of years. I started doing it during the pandemic. And one of the books that we read was the first of the Trans Wizard Harriet Porber books. And people in the book club did not really know what to expect. You know, when I said, hey, you know, I really want to read this, you know, book that Chuck came out with. And by the end of it, everybody was clamoring to, you know, get their paws on Straight because they had enjoyed, you know, the book so much. You helped one of my friends through a really bad, you know, bit of writer's block because of that's how great. You were talking about the nature of creation.
Yes. Oh, that's so kind. What a sweet story.
Yeah, the sincerity in your work is something that is really striking and something that I think has, you know, come through very powerfully in Camp Damascus.
Oh, thank you.
That's not, you know, horror is often not a medium that people, you know, think of traditionally, you know, as being a place for very sincere and very earnest conversations to be had. But one of my personal theories of horror that I've talked about in the podcast before is that it's one of the best ways to teach empathy, you know, because you're sympathizing with a main character put in terrible situations, or you're sympathizing with a monster also in terrible situations. That is not like you yourself. And,
yes,
you know, that was something that was extremely clear in Camp Damascus. Here's the awesome cover, because you have a protagonist who is neurodivergent and queer. And that's something that is not typically seen within, you know, a lot of popular fiction.
No, I don't think it's more now. But autistic representation specifically, you know, there's not too much of it. I would say there's certainly not a lot of it by an autistic creator themselves.
Yeah.
And so that was very fun to do. I think part of that too was because I am on the autism spectrum, and I also have a lot of there's things about my appearance, as you can tell, that are unusual just by definition. You know, you don't really see people wearing a pink bag over their head very often. And my voice has a certain affect, and so there's certain things about myself that are for privacy reasons, and there are certain things that are just kind of an expression of my autism, and it can be very hard to kind of sort those out sometimes for buckaroos. I certainly don't want them thinking, oh, every autistic person has to get their pink bag ready when they go out of the house, because that's what we all do. So I think after kind of parsing that so many times, I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I wrote a protagonist that was kind of exactly where I am personally at on the autism spectrum, so that when I was asked, I could just say, well, read this book. If you want to know what it's like in my head, outside of the mask and having to protect my identity and the voice, and, you know, there's certain things I have to talk about obscure things in my past too. I like to say, if I post a tweet online that says, oh, I pet a cat today, I might have pet a dog, but it's all kind of real in its own way. It's an honest expression. I just kind of need to veil certain things. And so writing Rose in Camp Damascus was very much me saying, I'm going to write a character that is exactly where I am at on the autism spectrum, and everything about it, very real experience. My stim is actually hers, of the counting 5 4 3 2 1 4 3 2 1. That is actually mine, and making note cards before social events, that type of thing. But there's just the thought process that I think when you're writing first person present, you're trying to get into the character. And a lot of the time, if I'm writing a, quote, neurotypical person, I remove those from my own writing. But with Rose, the whole point was leave it all in, just show exactly how you think. And that was really, really fun. It was a great exploration.
And it's been really great seeing how many people are relating to Rose and seeing themselves reflected in her, and her experience. The stimming alone, that's something that is very common. And it was striking me how similar it is to grounding techniques that, I've encountered during therapy too.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of, I think, because it's a spectrum, autism, also ADHD, a lot of the time, there's certain kind of, I think of them as cousins, we're all kind of in the same little family that kind of crossover. And I like seeing that. I love the reaction to it. It almost makes me cry every time I didn't see it, because, I know how important seeing autism represented was in art was to me younger, when I was younger, and there was very little of it. And then to kind of do that for other buckaroos, I think is so neat. And like I said, not as much autistic art by autistic people. And I think that because of that, I was kind of able to capture some of the things that are more subtle. You'll see a lot of autistic characters written by neurotypical people sometimes are exaggerated quite a bit in different ways. And, there's all kinds of ways to be autistic. So I won't say that those are wrong ways, but I think the particular one shown in Camp Damascus, it's nice, because I don't think it's covered very often, actually.
Yeah, it was making me think of, I went to school in Bozeman, Montana, was where I went to university.
Wow! Okay.
Yeah. And one of the books that we read, I was in a class for animal thought and behavior, and one of the books we read was by Temple Grandin, and she spoke there, and I think still speaks there fairly often. But she was writing about in the book how the best autistic representation when she was growing up was Data and Next Generation.
Oh, that was mine. That was mine too. Actually, that was, yes. I when I was diagnosed, I remember going to a therapist that I was seeing, and when that discussion kind of started, I knew from being a fan of Talking Heads and seeing David Byrne interviews, that he was my, oh, okay, this is a buckaroo acting with certain mannerisms that are my own. And then I'm really kind of researching that, and then, oh, he thinks that back then it was called Asperger's, which is what I was technically diagnosed with because it was a long time ago. But when I had that talk, I said, I feel like, I said both Data and Spock. I said, every generation I'm connecting to this one. I liked Data more because I don't know if this is going to rile up any buckaroos. I strongly prefer Next Generation. That's my one. I think technically maybe more Spock, because I felt like I have these emotions as Spock does, but I just don't express them, was kind of the way I said it. And I said, well, Data's not having them at all, kind of related to Spock more in the sense of the Vulcans are having them and have learned to kind of subdue them, which I don't know. Now I'm getting into deep Star Trek lore. I apologize.
There was that one single episode of Voyager with Tuvok and his anger issues that really spoke out to me. But Voyager has some issues.
Well, I think there was one. I recall one with Spock's father, where I think because he was getting older, he started to have emotional outbursts. I really like that one too.
Yeah, it's always fun to see, you know, who people relate to in each, you know, iteration of it and which one they like. Yes. But with you know, one of the interesting things I think is that, you know, for a very long time, it's, you know, people have been able to, you know, see sci-fi and fantasy as, you know, reflections of, you know, people who are neurodivergent, who are marginalized in some way. But I think that right now, maybe in part due to what was happening at the Hugo Awards relatively recently, some of that marginalized representation has shifted over to horror, which has, as a community, been much more accepting, you know, of promoting people, you know, these voices, you know, people writing about their own experience. You know, it's just something that I've been noticing lately.
Yes.
The StokerCon this year, a lot of the panels were focused on, you know, mental health in horror, you know, how to accurately, you know, portray these things with a big message of, you know, write what you yourself are experiencing.
Yes.
You know, or if you are writing something that you don't have, talk to people. You know, yes. Which is something I've seen you do online, even with your tinglers, when you started writing asexual tinglers, you know, you were reaching out.
Yes, yes.
I think that's an interesting thing.
Well, I'm surprised more authors don't do this. I find the buckaroos and my social media kind of presence such an incredible resource when I think there are some stories that are not mine to tell, but as part of the queer community, I think there's this, you know, like I said, with the kind of autism and the cousins, you know, I'm a few letters on the LGBTQIA technically, and so we can kind of reach out to the other letters and say, well, we're all family here, and kind of explore it under the queer umbrella, which is really what I like to do. But if I'm trotting over to a letter that I'm not entirely familiar with, you know, as the example you gave, perfect one, asexual, you know, I have this resource where I can say, hey, I'm going to write this book. I have this idea. What's kind of the best way to go about this? And then by doing that, I can learn a lot. And, you know, my new, the next horror novel that I'm putting out is called Barrier Gaze. There's three lead characters, and one of them is asexual. And that has a, I don't want to give any spoilers, but it is, I think it is an important part of the story. And, you know, it's nice that I could have this experience and talk to kind of buckaroos behind the scenes and stuff and make sure that I'm doing something that can lift up a community instead of add to the stereotypes or different things. And, you know, so I will say this their Ace Arrow character in Barrier Gaze is one of my favorite characters that I've ever written. I want to write a sequel to this book based on her, just because I love writing her. I thought I want to spend more time with this person. So, I don't think I could do that without using these communities. And what's interesting is other authors have this. I just don't see them using it very often. They don't just ask the question. I don't know why. It's so great.
One of the things that has, you know, in the past and, you know, still to a degree now, you know, happened with, you know, marginalized communities, whether, you know, they're, you know, queer or whether neurodivergent, you know, is that they tend to be infantilized by, you know, other people. You know, this is particularly true of neurodivergent people. And I thought that that was a very interesting thing that you were doing within Camp Damascus.
You were
addressing that and playing with that. And you've talked about this on your own, and I would happily direct anybody listening who's curious about this to your Tumblr with the Deconstructing Damascus series. But would you like to talk a little bit about how you were addressing that?
Yes. So, you know, Camp Damascus is, I did notice it, you know, with those two communities, it's just, you know, and I guess I should probably give a broader, you know, it is a story about a conversion therapy camp. The main character is Rose, who I very easily could have written as a teenager, because it would, I mean, with that story, it would be as easy as a find replace, because she acts like a teenager. All the friends act like teens. But I very intentionally said, okay, I want to create a feeling of kind of confusion and unease here. I want to put it right on that line, that edge of, are these adults or are these children? And technically they are adults. She's 20, but she's still in high school because of the way that this community works. Kind of as a commentary on the way, not just, I think, a lot of evangelical Christianity works, but specifically the way that they handle sexuality. You see it all the time with not wanting to teach, you know, banning books and all these things about kind of queer characters or any of this. Get that out of our schools, they're saying. But the interesting thing, the follow-up that's never asked is, well, it's not going to stop existing. You just want them to not have a way of dealing with this or understanding it or identifying with it, which is just what you do to children. These are all, queerness isn't going to go away when you get rid of books in classrooms or otherwise. And so by kind of saying, well, you can't handle this, you're just kind of treating everybody like children. So that was part of it. And I think also the way that they handle kind of abstinence, you know, it is natural to start to develop sexual feelings, and this idea of you can't explore that, these are wrong, all this stuff is just kind of, you know, you can't fight the biology of that as well. So I just saw across the board a sort of infantilizing of these communities and cultures. And so I thought, okay, in this book, instead of this camp where teens are taken, and by the way, there's also the question, it makes it more sinister, because if you think, oh, Rose is 20, legally, these people can leave, and they don't. They're not children. So I put a lot of effort to put it on the edge there. I knew that some buckaroos would think that there's feel maybe confused by it, because it is confusing, but it was such an important thing to me for the story to kind of show the way that these people were kind of kept as perpetual children. And then I added a sort of a Peter Pan metaphor layer to that, to show that as the, you know, the lost boys are kept children forever. Anyone in Neverland is kept young. And also to kind of give it a sort of, I think that based on the violence in it, and some of the themes, it is not YA, but I think that I wanted to give it a sort of kind of a teen YA, like, you know, walk that edge of, is this adult or is this, are these people young? And so, it, you know, it's a hard thing to do. And I think maybe some readers thought didn't, it made it more difficult for them to connect with, but artistically, I thought it had to be done.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I went into the book. I very carefully avoided reading the snippets that were released earlier or any sort of description. And when it was revealed that she was 20, which doesn't happen that quickly, that reveal, it was like a shoe dropping. It was this beautiful, unsettling moment. And the mixture between what could easily have been a YA book and some of the more brutal bits of violence that are in it was extremely unsettling. And it made a lot of sense with what you were describing as trying to create.
Thank you.
Because it is
that's a
very
hard thing to do. Yes.
It's unnerving.
Well, I appreciate you saying that so much, because I think that part of what's interesting, man, I don't know if I'm going to go too deep into the, here's what we're here for. We're going to go deep. But I feel like your interpretation of that is kind and generous. And I think it shows, I think that if you were to go into this book with a knowledge of who I am as a creator and not really know me and kind of not take me seriously, it would be easy to say, let's use your example, get to the 20-year-old part and think, oh, that's a mistake. That these people are acting young and they're 20. Oh, there's a hole in this book. Chuck did this wrong. And I think that maybe that might come from just the idea that it's pretty hard based on what I do to get taken seriously as a creator. But I think that if you were to come in and say, oh, there is someone doing something artistically, you hear that and you think, oh, that feels weird. There must be a reason for it. So, I did think about, I have this in Bury Your Gaze, and I thought, well, what's the better book to come out first? And I thought maybe this book would have, it's received very, very well, actually. All the reviews are very good, so I can't, I'm not even complaining. Yeah. I'm just kind of analyzing. But I think, gosh, if this was later where I was more established as a sort of legit horror author, I think some of the qualms, the rare qualms that would come up with that wouldn't happen, because they would not think, oh, this is just Chuck doesn't know what he's doing. They would think, oh, there's a reason for this. So that's very kind of you to say. I guess that was basically the most long-winded compliment to your reaction to actually give me the artistic space to do something that's feels like it could be a mistake, I guess, in some ways.
That's one of the interesting things that I think you've mentioned online as well, that a lot of people are talking about this book as if it's the first thing that you've published. This is Chuck's first book. And, it's your first traditionally published, book. But that's, even within the horror genre, that's ignoring Straight.
Yes.
Which is a striking book on its own. But with with Camp Damascus, in particular, I think that it's a very interesting commentary, especially now, with book bannings at an all-time high, to see this infantilization and to see how this development happens over the course of the book, because it could be viewed through the lens of a coming of age, but it's a stunted coming of age, because this is a coming of age that should have already occurred.
Yes, and yes, absolutely.
That's true of the other characters too. But you write about seeing this book through the lens of Peter Pan, not as a retelling, but, as that being a heavy influence, which is a really interesting thing, because one of the things people often don't think about with Peter Pan is what happens to the lost boys when they get too old.
Yes. Well, yes, not a lot are familiar with the original text of Peter culling the herd. So yes, in this, you know, it is not a retelling. You are correct. Although I guess you could see it as a sort of I don't even know. It's like a fantasy of what we kind of maybe wish Wendy could do in some ways.
Yes.
You know, but
I like that.
Yes. So you know, but in doing that, I thought, well, you know, if this is centered on Wendy as an allegory goes, you know, where is Peter in this? And I just kind of thought, you know, Peter and Captain Hook are kind of in the original one, if you really parse what's going on, a little bit two sides of the same coin. Yeah. You know, he is killing the Lost Boys when they get too old. There's some very sinister stuff. So yes, that is why, you know, the pastor is, it's Pastor Bend, which I think, you know, I'm surprised how few notice that Bend is another word for Hook. So you know, Pastor Bend is clearly an allegory in the allegory category, but also his name is Pete Bend. So he is, you know, kind of Peter Hook, an amalgamation of the two as a sort of hero villain hybrid at the end for Wendy to kind of confront.
Yeah, and it's, you know, a take on Peter Pan that, you know, isn't something that I've really seen discussed a lot. Because it's also carrying this message that it's all right to be growing up. You know, you can have a good time without the innocence of childhood. You know, you can grow into a more fully developed person and enjoy yourself. Because so much of media right now is heavily focused on the force of nostalgia.
Yes.
And a kind of longing to go back. But this was so much of a what comes next.
You yeah,
know, let's
well,
move
it
forward.
It is, you know, age is natural.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the most natural things that there are. I mean, across the timelines, you know, age is going to be a factor. And if you think about, you know, it's just natural. You can apply that to, you know, these sexualities that are being stamped down too by these, you know, kind of conservative powers. And it's just so interesting that these groups that kind of thrive on throwing out things like common sense or it just makes sense are really anti-nature as a force. They're really what they dabble in is creating kind of a false reality and kind of the uncanny, which is what Camp Damascus is all about. They are harnessing unnatural forces to, quote, make people more natural. You know, I guess if anyone listening, spoiler is probably yes. Coming soon. It's probably a good spot to stop if you're worried about spoilers. But, you know, that does end up backfiring because the thesis itself is wrong. No matter how you try to build on that foundation, you know, it is natural to age and to kind of love who you're going to love. I don't think the fight against that, I guess that's what gives me hope is for all the ups and downs. It is not really something that the conservative side could ever win. You know, it's just, you know, queer people are always going to exist.
One of the things that I found really interesting within it is that you have, you know, even on the cover of the book, the mayfly, you know, this very small insect that lives its entire life in a very short period of time. And in doing that, doesn't really have a life. You know, it matures, but it can't feed, it can't eat once it becomes fully grown.
It's very
so its only purpose
to think
is
about.
To reproduce and die.
Yes.
Yeah, it's scary. It's
I try to wrap my mind around just kind of the lifespans of I think about this a lot as I'm a vegetarian. So I think about it all the time with insects and stuff and kind of, you know, we're questioning these what is the worth of life, of the life of a cow, of the life of a cat, of the life of a mayfly. And so you do have to start thinking about questions of lifespan. What are you, if you squash a mosquito, what are you ending? I try to put myself in the headspace of, what if my entire life was 24 hours? Oh my gosh. Yeah. It sends me spiraling, but thank you for mentioning. I mean, that really is, it's interesting that came out in the text, because I feel like there's subtext to that you've pulled out is there. And I think about it all the time, but I wasn't even entirely aware of it.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought, because like within, one of the first scenes of the book, you know, she's having dinner and, you know, Rose is so excited that there's a little bit of extra garlic in the spaghetti.
Oh yes. You
know, what an absolute treat. And then, you know, again, we're in the spoiler zone now. You know, she vomits up the mayflies, this creature that can't even eat. And so it's like this pleasure that's being denied, this very natural thing, because to eat is natural, but then this, you know, creature that can't do it. And, you know, in terms of like just going against your own nature, you know, even the demons within the book are caught going against their own nature. You know, their nature is not necessarily evil. It's just different, because they're a different type of being. But even they're being constrained, which is a really interesting take on it all.
I mean, it is power. And I think that's kind of said in the book. And that was kind of the genesis of the idea was, you know, you have these, you have all these exorcism stories. And there's so many kind of demonic possession, hell stories. And I just always, when I see them, especially the possession ones, I always think, as a genre, there's something kind of, for lack of a better word, problematic about it. Because if we inherently say that these demons exist, you kind of are taking the fire and brimstone version of the Bible and then saying, this is the truth. And it's kind of never, ever addressed in these stories. In The Exorcist, nobody's stopping and thinking, okay, well, what does this mean for queer people? You know, there's so much. And I remember specifically, actually, I saw one of the Conjuring movies, and it is about a man who gets possessed and murders. I think it's The Devil Made Me Do It or something like that. And I don't want to disparage other works of horror. I thought it was okay. But the problem that I had with it really was that it is supposedly based on a true account. And I just thought, okay, if this man murdered someone and then years later the family has to watch a movie 30 years later that says, well, you know what? He was innocent and a demon got in him. I just think, God, there's so much. We just kind of let the religious horror genre get away with a lot of unanswered questions, I guess, is kind of what I'm trying to say. And so I thought, what if I did a kind of a story where we turn that on its head and we say, well, you know, if the church had this power of these demons, what would a certain church, I won't say all churches, because it's not an anti-religion book at all. It's more an anti using religion for hate. But what if, you know, someone kind of took that power and used it to espouse these values? What would that really look like? And what if demons were not some sort of a abstract thought, but a species of creature? So that is kind of where the genesis came from. And I just kind of thought, I haven't seen a lot of stories like that. You know, what's funny is the one that I can really think of is Event Horizon does kind of deal with hell as a real place. Yeah. But it's pretty rare to kind of see it that way.
Yeah, one of the I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Nat Segloff, who wrote The Exorcist Legacy, which is going through the history of the Exorcist films and films and books, all of that media. So I, over the course of a month, consumed every bit of Exorcist franchise material.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Was an interesting experience. But one of the things that I took away from it that has really bothered me is that there is an argument to be made that there's significant subtext within the book that Father Karras himself is queer.
Wow, there's interesting.
There's a couple scenes in it. There's one scene in particular where his friend, you know, says, "Oh, well, you're going to have to make a make a decision about what you do when you leave the church, because they're leaving the church in droves." And Kara says, "Who?" And he says, "Us queers." It's like, wait,
really?
What? Yeah, and I looked online.
That is almost not even subtext. That sounds like text.
It's right there. And I was looking online for anybody talking about this. And I found one post on Tumblr where somebody was mentioning it and nobody else has interacted with it. I put out a tweet, you know, talking about it, and a whole bunch of people from, you know, HWA were liking it, but like nobody has really written about it. And I think it's a super interesting bit because you have him being a boxer who at the height of his career stops and joins the church. And it's never explained why.
That is very interesting, yes.
Yeah, I just thought it was such an interesting thing, and I've never heard anybody talk about it, because that would change the story significantly.
Yeah,
and thinking about it in those terms.
You know, and through that lens, I think it almost, if that was the intent, answers some of the questions I had. You know, that's such an early example too, and you're starting to dabble in it. But in general, I think, you know, that is what I like about writing in general. But writing horror is within genres. I love genre. I love deconstructing genre. Horror has so many subgenres that that I think some of the greatest pieces of art within horror are the things that recognize horror and kind of draw out some of the unanswered questions of those subgenres. I think that's when something really kind of comes out and just changes everything. And, you know, that's what I tried to do with Straight. That's what I tried to do with Camp Damascus, obviously. And Barrier Gaze coming up is another version of that. These are just kind of, I think that curiosity is really what I find joy in, is to say, wow, we've been doing this for so long and no one ever thought, what's behind this door over here? So I think that's where so much of the fun and the joy lies in it. And I mean, something like, you can even look at, you know, Scream, when that movie came out. That's the perfect example of, you know, these things that just become phenomenons because someone says, wow, it's kind of interesting that we always do it this way over and over again. I wonder why. And that sort of, you know, I guess that's a sort of meta analysis, fourth wall breaking. Those are my favorite tinglers to write as well. That's what Harriet Porber is like as well. So I guess I'm just, you know, I do like holding that mirror to myself for sure, and to the genres that I play in.
Yeah, it was the newest version of Stephen King's It that took the werewolf metaphor in the book that was very, you know, firmly subtext and made it just overt text by, you know, outing Bill Hader's character there as queer. And, you know, having that be why he was so afraid of this beast within himself, you know, when he was younger. I love that sort of analysis, because I think that that's part of, you know, why, you know, certain marginalized groups tend to flock to horror, because we see ourselves, you know, through this lens that, you know, is just there under the surface. Like with Rod Serling's original intent with The Twilight Zone was very much that as well, you know, to hold a mirror up to society, but he couldn't do it literally. So instead he was doing it through, you know, the monsters are due on Maple Street.
Yes.
But one of the things that you mentioned before we decided to talk about The Exorcist, which is great because I have too much Exorcist in my head right now, was the fact that this is not an anti-religious text. And a fair bit of the religious horror that I've seen or in popular theory, because The Exorcist is pretty much a please join the church book, yes, grappling with faith, is very anti-religion. And that is not the case with Camp Damascus. I mean, not even all of the characters leave the book, as atheists or agnostics, which was something, yes, that was really striking to me. And yes, I thought,
I would say, of the three main characters, actually, I see the end of the book as that Willow is atheist and has been the whole time. I think that Rose's journey is deeply religious to atheist, then to agnostic. I think that Rose's journey is kind of a big swing, and that the end of the book is to kind of be in the middle, and maybe not even agnostic, maybe just a spiritual person. And then I think that Saul is just pretty deeply religious the whole time. So actually, within the three characters, there's kind of a hard on both sides, and then a middle ground, interestingly. So yeah, it is pretty even by the end. I think that I give a lot of everybody, who asks Chuck for advice, I generally, though I'm hesitant to give it out because I don't think there's any right way to do art. But one thing that I do often say is that, create with love as your fuel. And that can seem a little abstract, but I really think that Saul, who is the religious character in Camp Damascus, is a perfect example of what that looks like. I could have written Camp Damascus from an angry place, and I don't think that the character of Saul is in that story. But Saul is there because it is written from a place of love, and it's written from a place saying, there is a way to experience spirituality, even Christianity, that is not hateful, and here's a character doing that. So it was just, I think, because it was from a place of love, it was important for me to show that there are versions of that, and that the real enemy here is hate at the end of the day.
Yeah, and Saul is a very unique character in that way. There's a beautiful discussion, between him and Rose, where Rose is asking, how can you still believe, after all of the stuff that's been done to you? And Saul says that what the Kingdom of Pine is doing is not Christianity. It's not what actual belief is, because it doesn't have that core of love. The core of the Kingdom of Pine is a very different thing.
Yes. And yeah. Well, they got capitalism at the heart of what they're doing. Yeah. So it's kind of, that's a whole other tangent that you can go on, is what happens when you mix religious messages with a big teaspoon of capitalism. But I think that, and also Saul, I think, thinks, she says, Rose says, how can you still believe? And I think from his perspective, he's thinking, well, how the heck can you not believe? We just saw a bunch of dang demons. What else? Yeah. What else is there? So it is. I think that both of these perspectives have some pretty good points. I guess it probably helps that I personally am consider myself agnostic. So it's, I can, even if I give different weight to them, I say agnostic, but pretty much on the atheist side. But I have space for these different things. It's still very easy for me to see the real thoughts and feelings and arguments from either side of this when it comes to kind of spirituality and what is out there, which are some pretty big questions to grapple with. But it helps if you come at it from a place of love, for sure.
Yeah, and you've written about magic before, in your own personal life.
Yes.
And how the act of creation itself is, you're kind of married to those magical ideas. That's one of the big themes in the Harriet Porber books as well.
Yes, yes.
In a much more literal way.
Yes, it's sort of, having space for understanding that it's okay to not, see the cogs and the machinery behind everything. And it's also okay to try to see those, to try to work out everything, you know, as an autistic person, all I see is the dang cogs and wheels. It's all this big humming machine that I'm always trying to pick apart. And I think maybe why I arrived here is just even for my own health, you can go down that rabbit hole of trying to explain it all as deep as you want. That's fine. But for me, I kind of just realized, you know, some of this stuff, it's okay to just kind of let it float out there. And to know in my heart, you know, maybe there is a way that the cogs and wheels can explain this. But I'm not gonna get upset about it. Basically, you know, I can explain it or I cannot. I'm just going to let it be. So that's kind of where I have ended up with it.
It reminds me of the Mothman prophecies, where Richard Haddam wrote that, you know, the choice that he made was to live with the mystery, because the longer you try to explain it all, the crazier you get. So you just kind of live with the mystery.
You know, I never read that. But I saw the film, and I guess, I don't know. The film is mixed reviews, but I personally, I love it. I think it's same. Great. But wow. So compared to book, better or worse, how does it stack up? It's very different, isn't it?
I think it is very different, but I think that it goes with the book very well. The book is a lot stranger.
There's a lot
of things that couldn't be put in the movie for time restraint.
Okay.
But there's a lot of really bizarre things in there. I think about it often because, you know, it is a story of a guy trying to get to the heart of a mystery. And the closer and closer he gets, the weirder things get.
Yes.
So it gets more and more complicated. And that's like
call,
a lot of...
the phone call with Ingrid Cold sticks with me. Maybe I don't know why, it just sticks with me forever. I love that scene in the film,
it's beautiful.
You know, there's so much. It's interesting now that we're talking about it. There's a character in Barrier Gaze that only communicates through devices.
Oh,
we'll only call
cool.
someone on the phone, or if they're standing there, they'll only kind of appear on the television and talk through the TV. They never speak. And now that I'm thinking about that, there's some very specific influences for that character for me. But I'm thinking, gosh, I wonder if that scene from then, because it's just the way it's so eerie. I'm thinking, gosh, I wonder if I got something from that.
Yeah, I love how the influences come from such varied places. Yeah, I mean,
yes,
you were for Camp Damascus, you were taking from the book of the sacred magic of Abramelin the Mage. And I'm still not sure if I'm pronouncing that right.
That sounded so good. I believe in you. I think that's the best that's ever been said. That was amazing.
I was surprised to see that book crop up in your writing. It's a very obscure piece.
Yeah, well, you know, when you start digging into demonic lore, there is a lot of it. And I think what was so interesting and what I really like about Camp Damascus is that there's just so much... there's all these fantastical things that are all taken from real text. All of the demon names, these are all real demons. Well, they're not real demons, but mentioned demons. in actual old text. You know, the Holy Family and the Mayfly, which I mentioned, is a real painting. There's all these kind of, and also, you know, there's a lot of allusions to Dante. And so these are all these ancient and kind of older texts that are all being referenced. And through that, kind of an interesting little conspiracy theory is crafted, I think, which is kind of cool to take it from real resources, but there's just so much.
It's fun for me to go into digging through all these influences to, you know, figure out what might be there. I'm guessing that you're the same way, where
yes,
you just have to keep, you know, figuring things out to put them together.
Yes. Well, like, my influence is really, I'm you're not supposed to admit this as an author, but I do not read all that much. I do audiobooks. It's very hard. I think it's part of my autistic ways. It's very hard for me to read without my mind wandering. So I think my biggest influences are film and music and visual art. Pretty much, I love art. And it's just the actual process of reading is difficult for me. So I do think that there's some pros and cons to that. But one of the pros is that I think that my influences are very broad because of that.
I think that's cool, because that means that you're drawing from influences that a lot of other people aren't.
Yes.
So you're putting together something very unexpected. You have up on tour.com. You know, for those who are interested, you know, you've put together some playlists for the different characters, and you've put together some graphic novels that helped influence you as well, which is great, because again, these are two places that you don't often, you know, have people going when they're writing.
Yes. As far as reading goes, cool. Graphic novel, you know, I can do audios, but graphic novels, I tear through those. So I do really like horror graphic novels. I have a big bookshelf, and I'd say it's just about 95% horror, couple of superheroes, but pretty much all horror.
Yeah, I miss those, a lot of those old horror comics.
Oh, yes. Tales from the Crypt.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Giving me nightmares as a kid.
Yes.
But that's part of the fun. You know, I loved what you wrote about, you know, how you view horror, you know, how you can view it as an expression of love, because that's, you know, again, not a take that I think people are, you know, terribly familiar with. But I see a lot of that in your writing, and I think that anybody who reads your work will be seeing the same.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Thank you. That's very kind. That's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, so you're working on Bury Your Gaze right now. Is there anything else that you're working on that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
Well, no, I think, you know, that will be my focus. I'm always writing tinglers, always processing the current events and news of the day. But yeah, right now, Bury Your Gaze, I think that Bury Your Gaze is, you know, Camp Damascus was very personal in the way that I mentioned kind of the Rose's autism. Bury Your Gaze is very personal for another reason, in that, you know, I'm really trying not to say too much about it, because I think, like Camp Damascus, it is much better to go in kind of knowing nothing. I've kind of learned that the way that I write, especially first person present, is built for revealing mysteries slowly. But I will say that it's very personal. And very, I think that creators and artists, I think it's kind of a book for them. I think it's a book for artists and anyone who has ever, whether you're a musician or an author or a painter, it's really about creativity. And so because of that, it's super dang personal to Chuck. And so I think it's probably, I thought I was getting autobiographical with Camp Damascus in a lot of ways, but I think this is dang even more so. So I'm very excited about it. And if bookers like what Chuck has to say and want to support, pre-ordering bury your gaze is probably the best. Pre-orders in publishing, I don't know if Buckaroos know this, that is very important. So yes, if you're interested, then pre-order bury your gaze. That helps a lot.
And where can people find you online to follow the work that you're doing?
Oh, well, you know, on any platform, I'm going to be some version of Chuck Tingle. You can find me on there. I used to be able to say on dang Twitter, but we all know that that's gone to heck. I'm still there, but I feel like it won't be around for much longer. So, pretty much Instagram, Twitter. I very much enjoy Tumblr. I know that not a lot of Buckaroos are on Tumblr, but dang, here's me saying sign up for a Tumblr account. It's great.
Yeah, it's the only place where they're talking about the fact that Father Karras might have queer subtext.
That's how you know.
It's worth something, right?
That's how you know it's a great place.
Yeah, but thank you so much for coming here to talk to us. And I hope to see you again when Bury Your Gaze comes out.
Oh, thank you. I would love to come back. This was a great talk. Okay. Oh, well, wonderful. Okay, goodbye.
My thanks to Chuck Tingle for taking the time to speak with us. You can head over to his website at chucktingle.com. to find out more, buy his books or other merchandise, or get in touch. And there are links to all of his social media accounts on there too. Production is underway on the first episodes of our new storytelling project, Stories from the Hearth, a book at bedtime style podcast reading you old folklore books, stories and articles. If you'd like to be a part of this as a narrator or in some other way, please email our new address for that project at folklorepodreaders@gmail.com. Tracy Nicholas, who's heading up Stories from the Hearth, will be delighted to chat with you. Don't forget, your support is the only thing that keeps the podcast going as we head towards Season 9 in the new year. To make sure that we're still there for your folklore needs, please consider joining our Patreon from just £1 a month, where you can access extra content and help us to cover the time, the costs and the other work associated with running the big project that is the Folklore Podcast into the future. You can do that at patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast. Thanks for listening. See you next time.